You're listening to In the Vault, a KPMG banking industry podcast series.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Liz Lamadou, a principal in KPMG's banking and capital markets tax practice. And today I am joined by Grant Dalby, one of my Washington National Tax colleagues, a fellow member of our financial institutions and products group. Welcome, Grant.
Hi, Liz.
Today, we're going to talk through some year-end considerations for bank tax departments. So we want to start with a couple items that are new for 2023. And then we're going to go over, discuss some just yearly reminders that we think are good to check in on, make sure our elections are up to date, and ensure our T's are crossed and I's are dotted from a tax perspective. So Grant, let's start with the new items for 2023, and particularly the corporate alternative minimum tax, or CAMT. Can you talk us through a little short explanation, who's subject to the CAMT, and what should banks be thinking about for year end?
Yeah, just to give a little background, this is the provision from the Inflation Reduction Act that imposes a 15% corporate alternative minimum tax on the adjusted financial statement income of certain large corporations. And to be subject to the rule, those large corporations, you know, at a high level, would have to have an average of at least $1 billion of pre-tax net income, averaged over 3 years. And so the adjusted financial statement income, you kind of start with your net income on your financial statements, and then you'd make several adjustments from there, compute a corporate alternative minimum tax of 15% against that number, compare that to your regular tax liability, and then potentially be subject to the alternative minimum tax. So 2023 is the first compliance year, the first effective year for this provision, and there's still just a lot of outstanding questions. There's a lot of details and intricacies that have seemed to come into play here. And maybe I'll just highlight a few that are more relevant for banking or kind of specific to banking. A big one is adjustments that need to be made to financial statement income for partnership investments. And banks will frequently have partnership investments primarily due to, you know, tax credit partnerships is a very frequent vehicle for banks. And so the rules say that the statute says that when you're determining adjusted financial statement income for purposes of determining your corporate alternative minimum tax liability, corporations are supposed to adjust their financial statement income to include the distributive share of adjusted financial statement income of the partnership.
Do partnerships all have financial statements?
No. Yeah, I think that's one of the, you know, just a gating issue is, you know, the rule would kind of have you look at the financial statements of the partnership. But yeah, as you suggest there, it's not even common that some partnerships even have financial statements. So that's an initial question, is what's kind of even the starting point to do that analysis. And another, you know, thing too, as you know, Liz, partnerships, there's very complicated rules for how you take into account partnership investments for financial statement purposes. And there's different methodologies. There's the proportional amortization method. There's the deferral method. There's the equity method. And all of those methods have very intricate rules that go into them and different requirements and have various impacts on the way that those investments are reported on the balance sheet, the way that they're reported on the income statement, both in kind of the amount that gets reported on the income statement and also the geography, I'll call it, of, you know, where those different items, you know, come into play on the income statement, that all could potentially have an impact on how you calculate the numbers for CAMT purposes. And so there's just a lot of details and a lot of issues if you start thinking about it for even a few minutes on how to reconcile, you know, tax concepts to financial accounting concepts, and also reconcile it against this new tax regime. And so just a lot of questions there. And that could probably have a pretty meaningful impact to banks.
Agree. And I feel like there may be a lot of banks that are not ultimately subject to CAMT, or if they're subject to the regime, they may not have an actual liability. But it feels like there's a heavy documentation exercise to get to that point to show that there's no impact.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think it is heavy just because you have to work through, even if you may not be subject to the tax, ultimately, you still have to kind of work through all the mechanics of items like this partnership adjustment to prove that out. And those rules are just, seems like they will be pretty complex.
And one other question on this, there's appreciation adjustments for KMT. Is that right? Because we're taking book, but we get to take tax for certain items like depreciation.
That's right. Yeah. There's adjustments for depreciation where, you know, obviously you have different book depreciation and different tax depreciation, just in kind of the normal two worlds. But for KMT purposes, the rules let you use tax, you know, the tax methodology for determining the KMT implications. And so I think that's a pretty helpful adjustment for banks, particularly if they have large leasing portfolios with a lot of depreciation, because generally tax depreciation is going to be more favorable or quicker than book depreciation.
Yep, agreed.
Another area where you have tax conformity is mortgage servicing rights. You know, there's different rules for book and tax, but the KMT rules allow you to do tax conformity for any item of income in connection with mortgage servicing rights. I think there's some uncertainty there as to what any item of income means. For example, could it go so far as to include hedges of mortgage servicing rights is unclear. And there's also, I think, some rules that may apply in the context of excess servicing. I think it's unclear how that will be treated in the KMT world.
And if we think about a couple extreme examples, if a bank is subject to KMT, it seems like the tax-exempt investments could actually lose their benefits, right? They're exempted for tax, but if we're taking book income and subject to KMT using that, then that income could be subject to tax.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think that definitely impacts kind of the value of those tax exempt investments. It's historically been pretty straightforward that to see kind of how the tax return on those investments, but now you have to weigh in KMT and those may not be as valuable.
So definitely some complexity for purposes of figuring out KMT liabilities or whether a bank is subject to it. We're expecting regulation soon, but still don't have them. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think that's right. We've gotten a couple of notices throughout the year to provide interim guidance on certain items, but there's still a lot of items that are unaddressed. I think there's been indications that there's supposed to be proposed regulations that come out before the end of the year. I'm sure that'll be a nice Christmas present for some of us in the tax world to digest some of those regulations. But yeah, so I think we're expecting those before the end of the year. Interestingly, there was a notice that was released in September that kind of gave some foreshadowing of the proposed regulations. And it said that regulations would incorporate some of these items from the notice, and it would also address other items as well. The regulations would be effective for tax years beginning on January 1st, 2024. And previous indications had suggested that the regulations would be effective for the 2023 year, but this notice suggested 2024. So I think that tells you that corporations for 2023 purposes can proceed with their calculations based on interpretations of the statute and some of the guidance received to date.
That is interesting. And is there a form out yet for this grant?
There's a draft form 4626 that's been released, and you know, not surprising. I think that's also giving rise to questions and mechanics and on how to report everything. And so it's a lot of items, a lot of questions that are all trying to come together to get to one number. It seems like a big exercise. I think another area where it's important for banks to think about is in the regulatory capital context. One provision of the KMT that we haven't mentioned yet is that if a bank pays KMT in a year, if it's subject to the minimum tax, then it generates a tax credit that gets carried forward indefinitely and can be used to offset future tax liability. And so that tax credit that's generated would be a deferred tax asset that would need to be incorporated into the regulatory capital calculation. And so there needs to be kind of mechanisms to take that into account. And also, if you think about banks that are subject to stress testing, where they're doing, you know, taxable income calculations into the future and kind of projecting that, into the future, they'd also need to project the CAMT implications into the future and then, you know, work in the resulting potential DTA that arises. So that's an area where we've seen banks, you know, as you said, a lot of banks may not be expecting to be subject to the liability, but they have this documentation kind of requirement. This is another area where, even though they may not be subject to it, they have to kind of work in the mechanics into their process to kind of prove it out.
That is a great call out on the regulatory capital and just one more area of complexity for sure. So now I want to turn to another new item for 2023, which is the excise tax for stock repurchases. So new tax, which means new information to gather and new processes. So Grant, do you want to take us through this and considerations for year end?
Yeah, sure. And just to give a little background on what it is, again, this also is in the Inflation Reduction Act, and this introduced a 1% excise tax on repurchases of stock by certain publicly traded corporations. And the tax would be imposed on the fair market value of repurchases. However, there's a netting rule which allows corporations to net the fair market value of issuances against those repurchases, and the tax would be imposed on the net value for the year. There are a number of exceptions to think about. Exceptions from, you know, certain M&A transactions, stock repurchasing contributed to employer-sponsored retirement plans or similar plans, and so on. And so 2023 is the first applicable year for the excise tax. You know, this is kind of the first year that banks are needing to be thinking about this and thinking about where to gather this information. The information for that you would need to calculate this tax and satisfy the reporting requirements probably doesn't sit in the tax department. And so banks probably need to have communication lines with different segments of the bank to determine, you know, what all the repurchases were for the year, what's the fair market value, what's the issuances, and kind of pull all those pieces together in a way that they haven't needed to before.
Great explanation. And now for our final newish item for 2023, and that is IRC section 451B. This is a section that requires certain fees to be accelerated for tax recognition if they're recognized for book purposes. And we've got some new fees in 2023 that are subject to this. Is that right, Grant?
Yep, that's right, Liz. There's rules that are effective for 2023 that apply to what's defined as specified fees. And that definition is going to include fees that are associated with the debt instrument that are recognized upfront for financial statement purposes that would otherwise be treated as OID for tax purposes and spread over the life of the loan. So backing up for a second, you know, generally in the context of 451B, OID and the tax accounting methods for OID, original issue discount, are excluded from that book acceleration rule for 451B purposes because it's considered a special method of accounting. But there is a carve out to that for specified fees. So an exception to the exception. So essentially, you know, banks would need to look at what types of fees are recognized immediately for financial statement purposes. And then would those fees otherwise be treated as OID and spread over the life of the loan? Initially, this rule was only applicable kind of starting back in 2018 when it was originally enacted to credit card specified fees. But now effective in 2023, that rule gets applied more broadly than in the credit card context, and it applies to all specified fees that meet that definition.
And so for purposes of making this change for 2023, are banks required to file a method change, a 3115?
Yeah, that's right. The rule, it doesn't have like a cutoff concept where, you know, it's not like it only applies to fees received starting in 2023. Instead, the rule says that, you know, it's a method of accounting. So you would need to do a method of accounting change. You need to have a 481A adjustment to kind of catch up your prior recognition to this new methodology that's effective in 2023. And that's a non-automatic method change. So that would need to be filed if it's a calendar year taxpayer by that non-automatic method change would need to be filed by December 31st of 2023. So a very timely issue.
That's right. So thank you for that, Grant. That's it for new items that we wanted to discuss today that were new for 2023. But I do want to turn to just some reminders now. And these are the areas where we frequently see mistakes and think it's just good to revisit every year. So let's start with Section 475B identification. This is an area where I think once it's made, lots of banks put it away and tend to forget about it. But I think it's worth revisiting every year and make sure you don't have new accounts or you haven't changed anything for purposes of what's reflected in the ID. But what are you seeing around this, Grant?
I agree with what you're saying. You know, many banks are dealers in securities that are generally required to mark their securities to market under 475. And this 475B identification allows dealers to exclude securities held for investment, debt securities not held for sale, and hedges of items not subject to mark-to-market accounting if it identifies them as exempt on or before the date that they're acquired. And so I think I see a lot, you know, many banks will have this prospective 475B identification in place to capture these types of securities on a prospective basis so that they don't have to identify each and every new security. But when you're making that kind of prospective identification, you need to revisit it periodically to make sure that it's just working as it was set up to work and there's not new facts that you should think about in the context of this identification. So for example, I think like you suggested, Liz, you know, if the 475B identification works off of like GL coding, it looks at certain GL accounts, banks need to look at it to make sure that there hasn't been updates to GL coding or new accounts that they should think about in the 475B world. Another kind of common identification that I see is what we refer to as like reverse 475B identification, where the identification will just be set up to say all securities are hereby identified as held for investment or as debt securities not held for sale. And so it just makes this really broad blanket statement that all securities are identified for 475B and it meets those requirements as the securities that are eligible to be exempt. However, when there's changes in the business or changes in the way that transactions are structured or something, that broad blanket statement just may not operate the way that it's intended to operate. So for example, if a bank starts, you know, say in the past when it set up this ID, all it did was originate loans and hold them, you know, what if you fast forward to today, the facts that the business has changed. And so now they're, you know, not holding all their loans for sale or for investment, and they're holding some for sale. What if they're entering into interest rate swaps with customers and different types of securities? You just want to kind of evaluate your population of securities against the identification, just to make sure that it's working right, because there can be adverse rules if securities are not identified correctly or if they're improperly identified, where securities could be potentially subject to the higher of cost or market method of accounting, where gains but not losses are recognized, or maybe the character of, and then another implication would be that the character of gain or loss could be determined under general tax principles rather than the ordinary treatment under 475. Is that what you're seeing too, Liz?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think it's important to make sure that everything is as you expect with your ID matching your GL accounts and make sure there aren't changes in the business, like you said, because the ramifications can be large. I want to move on to another type of ID now, and that's hedging ID, because I think this is another area where we see common mistakes with some big implications for incorrect IDs.
Yeah, that's right, Liz. I think we see, you know, hedges that are being identified inappropriately sometimes for tax purposes. And then also even going further back, the hedges may not even meet the definition of a tax hedge for tax purposes. And so it could be subject to entirely different rule set. And just to give a little background, I think of it as four requirements to meet the definition of a tax hedge. First, the hedge has to be entered into by the same taxpayer that bears the hedged risk. Second, the risk has to be related to interest rate, price, or currency risk. And then third, the hedge has to be entered into in furtherance of the taxpayer's business. And then fourth, and really importantly, the hedged item has to be an ordinary asset or an ordinary liability. And then from there, the rules say that, you know, if you meet the definition of the tax hedge, to avoid certain unfavorable tax rules, you also have to identify it as a tax hedge on or before the day that it's acquired. And so some of the implications of the hedge rules is that, you know, that if it's a tax hedge, it's subject to unique timing rules where you would match the P&L from the hedge with the P&L from the hedged item. And then also gain from a tax hedge is ordinary if it meets the definition. And then loss would also be ordinary if it's identified, if it meets that identification requirement that I talked about. And so I think some of the common mistakes that we see and common footfalls is, like I said, it doesn't qualify as a tax hedge. So common example there is purchase mortgage servicing rights. If it's a hedge of PMSRs, then it's not going to qualify as a tax hedge because the hedged item, the PMSR, can sometimes produce capital gain or loss. So that's a common footfall. Another area we see in the identification world is that, you know, banks or taxpayers assume that, you know, we're identifying this hedge for GAAP purposes. And there's all these different requirements for hedging for GAAP. And so they assume that if it's identified for GAAP, then it ought to be identified as for tax as well. But that's just not the way that the rules work. The rules under Section 1221 require specific language for tax. And then another implication or footfall that we see in the identification is that, you know, maybe an identification is made for 1221 purposes. However, you'd also probably want identification under Section 475B, because a lot of times a hedge is going to meet the definition of a security. And to kind of get the results and the timing results that you'd expect, you'd need to think about, you know, the treatment under 1221 as a hedge, and then also make sure that it's not being pulled into the 475 rules, assuming that it meets the requirements under 475B. So I kind of almost think of it as two identification requirements for banks, typically under both 1221 and 475B.
Agreed. And a lot to think about there, but I want to focus for a second on the implications of bad hedge or ID. You mentioned the character issue as one of the implications of a bad hedge or ID. What are some other implications that you see?
Yeah, that's a great question, Liz. I think one of the issues I see a lot with bad hedge IDs is straddle implications. And I won't get into the details of the straddle rules, but, you know, a lot of times, if you're hedging an item, you will have a straddle because they're offsetting positions. The straddle rules would have you, if you have a loss with respect to one of those positions, that loss could get deferred to the extent of unrecognized gain in the offsetting position. So that can result in, you know, unfavorable rules where you're deferring losses but recognizing gains, and then also just challenging tracking exercises in determining what your realized losses are, what's your unrecognized gain, and kind of how that gets freed up over time. And if a hedge is properly identified, then it's the hedge, but not the hedged item. The hedge is accepted from the straddle rules. And so that kind of takes that issue off the table, at least with respect to the hedge. Another area I see is, you know, Section 1256 contracts are oftentimes used as tax hedges. And those have unique timing rules and character rules where, you know, Section 1256 contracts are marked to market, and then they're subject to, you know, their capital generally, where 60% of gain or loss is long-term capital gain or loss, and then 40% is short-term. Those special character and timing rules are turned off when it's a properly identified tax hedge. So that's another area where that can kind of identifying can help alleviate both, you know, unfavorable impacts and also just the kind of the complexities that come along with that. And then maybe a third item that can come into play is reportable transactions. So there's these rules for reportable loss transactions where if a loss is greater than a certain number, that for corporations that number is 10 million in a single year, then that taxpayer has to report that loss to the government. But if the loss arises again from a properly identified tax hedge, it's accepted from that reportable loss rules. So if it's not identified and it's generating losses, then, you know, you'd have to go through the reportable loss rules. So that's just another area. And there's more as well. I think those are some of the big ones.
Thanks, Grant. One other reminder I wanted to plug for year end is just around tax exempt investments. And that's the reminder that 265A2 applies before 265B. A2, you remember, is the direct tracing rule, so that if any of your tax-exempt investments can be directly traced to an item of debt, debt could be subject to disallowance rules under the direct tracing. And that would come out of the calculation before the bank does the more general 265B calculation, which is the ratio. And Grant, any other particulars around tax-exempt investments for reminders?
Yeah. So you covered there's the rules for interest expense related to tax-exempt investments. There's also rules on the income side that's coming off of these tax-exempt investments where, you know, there's different rules for OID, market discount, and also premium. OID is tax-exempt, just like stated interest. However, market discount is not tax-exempt. And then premium associated with a tax-exempt investment is not deductible. However, amortization reduces basis over time. And so there's, you know, these three kind of buckets: OID, market discount, premium. And banks should really understand, you know, what numbers are associated with which bucket. I think sometimes banks rely on reporting from a third-party provider where it gets, you know, just kind of summarized numbers that they'll use for financial statement purposes. And tax departments should really be digging in, trying to understand what those summarized numbers represent to understand if there's different rules in the tax-exempt world. And I think these numbers, Liz, from tax-exempt, both on the expense and the income side, are just going to be bigger in 2023, don't you think? Just because the way that we've seen interest rates rise over the past year.
Absolutely. So if there was ever a year to revisit this, I think this year is a good one. And then for our final reminder, I wanted to just touch on the conformity election. I think a lot of our banks have made this election, which allows the tax to mirror book for purposes of bad debts. But there's a couple items that we want to make sure they're taken into account on this as well.
I agree. I think a lot of banks have made the conformity election and kind of just rely on this methodology to follow the kind of, I'll call it the change in balance approach with allowance for loan loss to be able to recognize charge-offs, book charge-offs for tax purposes. I think a common mistake that kind of flies under the radar sometimes is that to make the conformity election and to have that be applicable, the bank has to receive a letter from its regulator upon each exam cycle, just kind of confirming that its methodology for charge-offs is appropriate and kind of is eligible to be followed for the purposes of the conformity election. And I think sometimes, you know, banks will have made this election in the past. Maybe they even got the letter from the regulator in the past, but they kind of forget to bring that up upon each exam and make sure that they're getting that for their files to technically be able to stay on the election.
Great reminder, Grant, and well said. So I want to thank you, Grant, for taking us through all of this today. Great discussion, timely information, lots of good things to think about for year end. And to our audience, thank you for joining us today. This is Liz Lamadou on behalf of KPMG's Banking and Capital Markets Tax Practice. I look forward to talking again soon.
Thanks for listening to In the Vault with KPMG. Be sure to subscribe to this series to be notified of new episodes.